has won it. They stream out of the dugout. Yeah. Rollins ball near third. This game is over.
Second deck walk-off home run. Grand slam, Bryce Harper.
That's what I call hitting season.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode 513. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Coming up, some Philly stuff to get to. We'll look at some of the Phillies arbitration players and who could be back, who will not be back, and how much could these guys be looking at next year. Some of those salary numbers will be a big reason why some of those guys might or might not be back. We'll take a look at the Atlanta Braves and the Philadelphia Phillies and what the two teams did at the trade deadline, and some interesting aspects to that, and that is one of the reasons the Braves are still playing baseball right now. And we're going to talk about the Phillies' outfield situation for 2022 with Evan Macy, who's the managing sports editor at Philly Voice. That's coming up in a few minutes. We'll also give you the latest on the MLB playoffs. The NLCS and the ALCS are still ongoing, and some of the big storylines coming out of those series, the death of starting pitching, the strike zone in the ALCS Game 3, and some other postseason fun stats for you there. Pace of play we're going to get into as well here in just a few minutes, all coming up on Hittin' Season. But before we do that, just a reminder, folks, check out the Hittin' Season Patreon. That's at patreon.com/hittinseason. Lots of cool bonus stuff up there for you. And if you just want to make a donation to help us out, you can do that as well. Sign up on the $1 or the $5 a month tier. We also have a special tier that you could sign up for to get extra bonus stuff. Again, that's at patreon.com/hittinseason. All right, let's start off by taking a look at some of these Phillies arbitration numbers. And NBC Sports Philadelphia did a pretty good breakdown of this. I think it was Jim Salisbury, although it might have been Corey, not remembering off the top of my head. But obviously, the Phillies have a number of players who are coming up for salary arbitration this offseason. Now, the collective bargaining agreement, as we've talked about, the negotiations for that are ongoing. Those are set to expire on December 1st, but that's also the deadline for teams to non-tender players who are on their 40-man roster who have less than 6 years of big league service time. And when a team non-tenders a player, that player then becomes a free agent. So, for instance, last year, Vince Velasquez and David Hale were two players on their 40-man roster who could have been non-tendered. However, the Phillies kept both of those guys. You will remember Velasquez signed for $4 million, Hale for $850,000. Those, if they could go back and do it again, are moves the Phillies probably would not do again. So this year's non-tenders: Rhys Hoskins, Zach Eflin, Jose Alvarado, Ronald Torres, Andrew Knapp, Travis Jankowski, Sir Anthony Dominguez, Roman Quinn, and Odubel Herrera. Now, salary is likely going to factor into this. There's no way the Phillies are bringing Odubel Herrera back at $11.6 million, and they are probably happy to just be done with him. Odubel Herrera will not be back in 2022. Let's talk about the guys who absolutely will be back. Rhys Hoskins will be back. MLB Trade Rumors estimates that his raise in arbitration will take him to about $7.6 million next year. That's still a steal for the production that he gives you at first base. So Rhys Hoskins will absolutely come back. Zach Eflin, set to earn about $6 million. He'll be back. They're not going to trade him this offseason. They're certainly not going to non-tender him, so he'll be back. I think one of the interesting names here is Jose Alvarado. Going to probably make in the neighborhood of $2 million. I think this is one of the few trades the Phillies have made in the past off seasons that actually worked out pretty well. Jose Alvarado wasn't the sub-2 ERA guy we were hoping we would see that pitched for the Rays in 2018. He was all over the place. He's too unreliable to pitch in the ninth inning and maybe even in the eighth inning on some nights, but he's just got too electric of an arm. The stuff is all there, and most nights he got the job done. He's Mitch Williams on crack. There's just no other way to put it. But I would keep him around for $2 million because you don't find many left-handed relievers with that kind of arm. And when he is throwing strikes, he's an animal. So I would keep Jose Alvarado at about $2 million. Now, Ronald Torres is set to make probably in the neighborhood of $1.6 million. Obviously, Joe Girardi loves him. It would not surprise me at all if the Phillies keep him around because they do lack infield depth in the organization. I would not keep Ronald Torres. I think you can get a similar type of player for much less money than $1.6 million. So I would not bring Torres back. I have a sneaking suspicion the Phillies are going to bring Torres back simply because Joe Girardi likes him a whole lot. Andrew Knapp at $1.2 million, he will not be back. The Phillies, I think, are ready to give that job to Marchand. If they're not, again, I think you can find a backup catcher for around that money who will give you more production than, I think, Andrew Knapp had an OPS below 600 this year, if I'm remembering that correctly. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but it was around that. Travis Jankowski for $900,000. I'm not keeping Travis Jankowski. He was fine for a couple of weeks, but that's just, you know, I'll bring him back on a minor league deal again. And, you know, maybe stash him in AAA next year if he's willing to do that. But I'm non-tendering him. Sir Anthony Dominguez, I think that they will bring him back. He's slated to make about $800,000. They've spent all this time watching him try to rehab from Tommy John. He pitched in the minors last year over the last few weeks. I think they're hopeful that he can get that velocity back up to where it was before. And if he can, then he becomes a valuable member out of that bullpen. And I think they want to give him that chance to do that. I don't think they're ready to cut him loose and say goodbye to him. So I think Sir Anthony Dominguez will be back. Roman Quinn, the last guy on this list at $700,000. It's cheap. You know, Roman Quinn's cheap. I don't think you can guarantee him a roster spot next year. So unless the Phillies are going to be aggressive adding players to the 40-man roster this offseason and you're ready to move on from Roman Quinn, I'd probably bring him back. But I would also look to see what else is out there because you just can't rely on Roman Quinn to be a part of your baseball team. And I think it's time the Phillies move on from Quinn and just look someplace else for that kind of a player. There are other players like him in other organizations. And I think some other options... I think the Phillies would do well to give themselves some other options for outfield depth. And so I would probably not bring Roman Quinn back. But if they did, you're probably talking about $600,000, $700,000 for next year. It would be hard to argue with it because you're not guaranteeing him a spot on the 26-man roster, but you are giving him a spot on the 40-man. And again, I want the Phillies to be aggressive, more aggressive than they have been in recent seasons, going out and trying to poach players from other teams, players that the Phillies, you know, that other teams are not going to be able to protect on their 40-man rosters because they just have too many players that they need to protect. And so I would love to see Dombrowski and Sam Fold go out and be aggressive in adding a ton of players, making a bunch of trades this offseason, and moving on from some of the guys like Roman Quinn, who have, no offense to Roman Quinn, just not produced and not been effective and are indicative of some of the things that have held this team back in recent seasons. And certainly I'm not bringing Odubel Herrera back at $11.6 million, and I'm probably not bringing him back in any way, shape, or form. So we're talking a little bit about salary here because it is going to matter. It is going to matter a little bit what the Phillies, how much the Phillies are going to tie up to arbitration players and everything else because, you know, one of the things that the Phillies, that was a factor during the trade deadline this past season, was the luxury tax. The Phillies were snug up against the luxury tax. I think they were probably $2 or $3 million away from it. And I wrote a piece for The Good Fight this week, taking a look at what the Atlanta Braves did at the trade deadline, because obviously their trade deadline acquisitions produced for them over the last 2 months of the season and continue to produce for them in the postseason. And it's frustrating as a Phillies fan to watch the Braves go out and get four veteran players and watch all of them produce. And the instinct is to just say they got lucky. And there is no doubt whatsoever that the Braves got lucky with the production that they've gotten from all the different players. And I think back to some of the trade deadlines the Phillies have had these last few years, and specifically to 2018, when the Phillies tried to do a similar thing. They tried to buy in bulk and add some players to the core. Again, this was not a time when the Phillies were going all in. This was the first year of Gabe Kapler, the first year where they just had Jake Arrieta. They brought in Carlos Santana. They moved They moved Rhys Hoskins to left field. You can see why I would automatically, you know, move to Darren Ruff in left field when thinking about that. But, you know, this was a season in which, you know, the Phillies were not going all in. But I don't know that the Braves were really going all in here at the trade deadline this past season. When Ronald Acuña went down on July 10th with a torn ACL, He had played 82 games, had a team best 990 OPS, an OPS plus of 155. He'd hit 24 home runs, had stolen 17 bases, but the Braves were still just 44-44. They were 4.5 games out of first place in the NL East. They hadn't been over 500 all season. Remember, the Braves didn't get to over 500 until early August, before they hit 500. Now, they did have Freddie Freeman still and Dansby Swanson and Austin Riley and Ozzie Albies, but, you know, all those players had been inconsistent. The pitching staff was not pitching well, and the Braves just didn't look like they were going to right the ship. It looked like a death knell for them, but to his credit, Alex Anthopoulos did not give up, and I don't think he pushed all his chips into the middle of the table here, but he went out and he got Jock Peterson. He went out and he got Jorge Soler, Adam Duvall, Eddie Rosario, four guys for their outfield. He got four guys to replace Ronald Acuna. And here's what they did. Jock Peterson, in 73 games with the Cubs, had a 713 OPS. In 64 games with the Braves, had a 752 OPS. So an increase of 39 points. Not huge, but he's been extremely productive in the playoffs, as we've seen. Jorge Soler had a 658 OPS in 94 games with the Royals. That's an 882 OPS in 55 games with Atlanta. 658 to 882. Goodness gracious. Adam Duvall had a 755 OPS in 91 games with the Marlins and an 800 OPS in 55 games with Atlanta. And look at Eddie Rosario. Eddie Rosario, my goodness, a 685 OPS in 78 games with the Indians this year, a 903 OPS in 33 games with Atlanta, and he is doing major damage in the National League Championship Series. He might be the NLCS MVP. He had that huge walk-off hit for the Braves in Game 2 of the NLCS. He's had a huge Game 5 for them against the Dodgers. I mean, goodness. A huge Game 4 for them. You contrast those deadline moves with the moves the Phillies made, both this year and in previous years. I mean, let's look at this year. Dave Dombrowski, he did address a huge weakness in the starting rotation by trading for Kyle Gibson. And then he got what he hoped would be a stabilizing figure in the ninth inning in Ian Kennedy, and then he also later traded for Freddie Galvis. Well, Kyle Gibson had a 2.87 ERA in 19 starts for Texas. He had a 5.09 ERA for the Phillies and a 4.04 FIP. He's going to be back in the rotation next year for the Phils. Ian Kennedy had a 2.51 ERA and a 3.66 FIP in 32 innings for Texas. That ERA was 4.13 for the Phils and a 6.21 FIP in 24 innings for the Phillies. And then Galvis, of course, didn't do much of anything. Had a 720 OPS for the Orioles, a 684 OPS for the Phillies, and he missed the first month after getting here because of an injury. Now, I think the Phillies, the guys that they, Gibson and Kennedy, were higher profile guys than what the Braves did. But obviously the Phillies had far less to show for it. The Atlanta's bulk purchase worked out. I mean, all four guys worked out. And it reminded me of 2018, like I mentioned before, when the Phillies went out and got Asdrubal Cabrera, Wilson Ramos, Jose Bautista, and Justin Bour. Now, a couple of those guys worked out okay. Ramos had an 834 OPS with the Rays and an 879 OPS with the Phillies. He was good with the Phillies, but he missed the entire first month with an injury. He missed all of August. Bautista had a 718 OPS with the Mets. I didn't realize he had an 870 OPS with the Phillies, but only had 45 at bats in his one and only month with the team. Because remember, he was a September addition. Asdrubal Cabrera was the biggest guy that the Phillies got. Had an 817 OPS with the Mets. It was a 678 OPS with the Phillies. And then Bour had a 759 OPS with the Marlins and a 643 OPS with the Phillies. And we'll remember that 2018 Phillies team went 8-20 in September in Gabe Kapler's first season here as a manager. I don't think those moves are a whole lot different than what Anthopoulos did here in 2020. So yes, there's some luck there. And the Phillies have been unlucky with trade acquisitions every year since. In 2019, they went out and they traded for Drew Smyly. And signed Jason Vargas. And they didn't do very much. Those were not moves where the Phillies pushed their chips into the middle of the table. They were scared of the Dodgers. Remember, they were saying they didn't want to go all in because they knew they couldn't beat the Dodgers. They were afraid to compete with the Dodgers. Imagine if the Atlanta Braves had had that mentality. If they'd been afraid to go play the Dodgers and the Giants, the Braves wouldn't be where they are right now. And then you had the 2020 deadline. Now, again, that was a weird deadline because of the pandemic, but that was the year the Phillies last year brought in all those relievers, and they all blew out, flamed out incomprehensibly. So, yes, some of this is luck. There's no way Anthopoulos could have known that he would get this kind of production from the four outfielders that he brought into the fold. And it was admirable of him not to give up and give his team a chance over the final 2 months to stay in it. Not to be scared off by the Brewers and the Dodgers and the Giants and the Cardinals, all these teams with better records. It's clear from the deals that he made that he knew the odds were kind of long because he didn't go out and he didn't get a couple of superstar players. But he tried to buy a lot of different guys and bring a lot of different guys in, and it's worked out spectacularly. But this also has a lot to do with the financials. We can't just say that this is all about luck. The Braves, when they went and the four contracts that they picked up with these guys had adjusted salaries that cost them $8.1 million. The Phillies' adjusted salaries for Kennedy, Gibson, and Galvis accounted for under $1 million. Had the Phillies spent $8 million at the trade deadline, they would have gone over the luxury tax, but you can wonder whether or not the Phillies would have actually been able to get real reinforcements to help their team that was falling apart. It was crumbling like Herbie at the end of The Love Bug, where they had to hold it together where they're trying to weld it together at the tail end before the dadgum team splits in two. I mean, you can imagine Dave Dombrowski sitting in the back seat with a flamethrower trying to weld the car together. That's what the Phillies were like. If they'd spent $8 million at the trade deadline, you really wonder what they might have been able to do. Could they have kept up with Atlanta? Remember, they went into that final series of the season against Atlanta two games back with a three-game series to play. Would they have done better against some of the bad teams on their schedule? I mean, they added 922,000. One of the reasons they went with Kennedy and Gibson was because Texas agreed to pick up a lot of their salary. So I think it's fair to note that had the Phillies spent that kind of money, $8 million, they would have gone over the tax. And while Dombrowski continues to say he has no payroll restrictions, all of the moves that they have made indicate otherwise. So to say the Braves solely got lucky at the trade deadline is not 100% true. They gave themselves a chance to be lucky. But they were also willing to spend a bit to bring in additional talent. And they were further beneath the luxury tax at the start of the season. And that's because they have developed their own young players as well. So they haven't had to spend as much on players throughout the rest of the roster. Whereas the Phillies were right up against the luxury tax. And they do see that as a cap for them. And that limited what they could do at the trade deadline. And that's why the Braves are on the verge of getting back to the World Series. And the Phillies are watching. And it's one of the reasons. It's not the reason. It's one of the main reasons why the Braves are they're on the doorstep of the Fall Classic, and the Phillies are home watching postseason baseball for a 10th straight season. It is no coincidence. Coming up, we're going to talk to Evan Macy, managing sports editor of Philly Voice. He had a really good piece taking a look at what the Phillies might do as far as outfield options in 2022. Laid down some of the free agent possibilities that are out there and also some trade possibilities. We'll talk to him coming up next here on Hittin' Season.
One of the areas the Phillies are going to be addressing this offseason is obviously the outfield. Bryce Harper can't play all three positions, last I checked. Even if Major League Baseball allowed it, which I guess they would, it wouldn't be conducive to his health or defensively would be an issue. But nevertheless, the Phillies are going to have to go out and get some outfielders here this winter. And Evan Macy, who's the managing sports editor at Philly Voice, had a real good piece kind of breaking down the free agency options and some of the options that could be available in trade and why this is a problem right now. Evan is, you can follow him on Twitter at Evan_Macy. Evan, thanks for coming on Hittin' Season. How are you?
Yeah, John, great to hear. Thanks for having me, man.
It's great to have you. And, you know, I thought the piece was really good because when you started off talking about how we got here, I started thinking about how few homegrown outfielders this team has actually developed, even over the last 30 years. The Phillies don't develop their own outfield talent. Pat Burrell is really the only guy, maybe in the last 20 to 25 years, that they drafted and developed and a guy who turned into a decent outfielder, and that's not even a guy who was a multiple all-star. And you took a look at some of the high draft picks this team used on outfielders in 2015, 2016, 2017. And, you know, talk a little bit about how those draft mistakes have kind of put us in the position where we are right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to blame the first round picks because they're the names everybody knows and they have a spotlight on them. But I mean, the fact that the Phillies have really completely missed on every single first round pick they've had since the, you know, the 2008 run is just really a detriment and a statement about how terrible this front office has been with drafting. They spent the first overall pick in Mickey Moniak, and, you know, it's interesting because the type of prospects that this team has are not the type of prospects that you want to have based on where the Phillies are in the contention cycle, which is to say that they have the Bryce Harper contract, they have Zach Wheeler, they have JT Realmuto. They don't really have the time or the space in the lineup sheet to bring up a Mickey Moniak and let them develop slowly to see what they have in somebody, you know, like Adam Haseley, who we've seen he's mediocre, or even Cornelius Randolph, who's the other of the three draft picks. So you have these guys that are just, you know, floating along in the high minors, not doing much, and you don't really have an opportunity to see them make the jump because you have to win now. So they're in a really tough spot with these guys because based on when they drafted them, you have a guy who's 23, 24 years old who was the first overall pick. He should be a starter at the lineup right now, and it's a big problem that he's not.
It really is, and you mentioned also that they do have some other outfielders who are under the age of 22, Jalen Ortiz, Ethan Wilson, Simon Muziotti. But again, these are not guys that most prospect experts think are going to be world beaters, and none of these guys have much AAA experience, so they cannot be relied on to be any part of the solution for 2022. And of course, we know Andrew McCutchen's going to leave. He had a really weird season this year. He had 27 homers and 80 RBIs, but only hit 222. The Phillies are not going to pick up his option. Center field, there obviously was a problem all season long, and there is no way they're bringing Odubel Herrera back. So, kind of what you know. And you listed everyone who started a game in center field for the Phillies since 2019. It's really an impressive list. I'm just going to read it real quick. Adam Haseley, Roman Quinn, Moniak, Travis Jankowski, Odubel, Luke Williams, Matt Vierling, Jorge Bonifacio, Bryce Harper, Ronald Torres, Scott Kingery, Aaron Altair, and Andrew McCutchen. My goodness, that's 13 different center fielders starting a game over the last 2.5 years. So is there an in-house option here? Like what can... Is there someone who's already on the roster that could play center field every day next year for a contending team?
So the way that I really look at this roster and the pieces that they have is there's actually a little bit of versatility and maneuverability. And I think that the key for them contending is them getting creative with what they do. And I know one of the options I explored, and there's a lot of different ways they can go with this, but if they were to move Rhys Hoskins to the other corner outfield spot, and then they were to move Alec Bohm, assuming that he's back next year in the bigs, to first base, then they would be able to go after a free agent who's a lot more desirable, like a Chris Bryant or like one of those stud, you know, Chris Correa or Carlos Correa, like those the shortstop free agents.
Yeah.
Because the free agents that are available in the outfield are really not that interesting. They're not that exciting. They're around replacement level. The trade options, you know, you don't really want to deplete this farm system even more. So I really think that the key is if they improve the infield by free agency, maybe Bryson Stott is ready to go and you put him in the infield. Then, you know, the infield becomes less of a burden because you don't have two spots that you have to fill with this ragtag group. You have just one. So I think that the guys that they have, if the infield is packed with hitters, you know, they could maybe make it work with what they have. I mean, Roman Quinn is out minor league options, so he'll probably start with the big league club or he'll get designated for assignment. And then you have all these guys like Vierling, Luke Williams. You know, none of them really did much to show that they can start, but they'll get a chance to compete for a role in spring training. It's not going to be an exciting position battle to watch, but I really do think that the money that they have to spend in free agency is best spent addressing third base or shortstop. and then move the pieces they have to fill in holes otherwise. Who knows, maybe they're in a position to get a better outfielder come trade deadline if everything goes well next season.
Yeah, and I think anytime you mentioned moving Rhys Hoskins out to the outfield, that sends shivers down everybody's spines. And I don't see the Phillies going in that direction, but I understand the logic behind it, because the impact players in free agency really are in the infield. You mentioned some of the outfielders who could be out there. I think Chris Bryant's a great fit. We saw him playing center field for the Giants in the playoffs, and he could slide right in and be a center fielder. We know the friendship he has with Bryce Harper, and I don't think he's going to cost more than mid-20s per year. I just feel like he's getting a bit older. His season was a little up and down this year. He came up a great season last year, but was kind of down the season before that. So he seems to me a guy who you could probably get in the $24 to $26 million a year range over 4 years, as opposed to, you know, the Phillies have luxury tax issues even going into this offseason, that they're going to be having trouble to sign a guy to another $30 to $35 million a year contract. So I like the idea of Chris Bryant, but you also mentioned a couple other potential free agents that are out there who a couple of these names would not be bad at all.
No, not really. You have guys that are probably going to be affordable. They're in their early 30s or late 20s. Michael Conforto is going to be a free agent. You have Jock Peterson. You have guys who kind of own flashes but don't have career bodies of work that would earn them those big $20 million contracts. So it would make sense to bring one of those guys in, maybe to have them start with the role, and then hopefully he'll either be unseated, one of those young guys. And I just want to defend, I know Rhys Hoskins in the outfield, that's not exciting. But the only reason that I am going to stand by that is because the defense is not going to get worse than we've seen in the last two seasons. You see a team like the Dodgers that is really going offense first, and they're sacrificing their defense for better or for worse. And that seems to kind of be a strategy that works for these winning teams. And I'm almost wondering if you just load the lineup with bats and then figure out who plays where, maybe that will be better than doing that, but with people that can't hit.
Yeah, no, I understand. I certainly understand that logic. And you mentioned a couple other guys here. Corey Dickerson, former Philly, he's 32. Tommy Pham, Starling Marte, both 33. Marte would be a nice addition depending on the cost. Dexter Fowler, 35 years old. There's also a couple of guys you mentioned that are based on player and team options. Charlie Blackman, Kyle Schwarber. Nick Castellanos is a guy a lot of people have connected to the Phillies simply because, like you said, he's not a good defender, but he's a great stick, and he's a guy you could put in left field, and you know you're going to get good production there. Jackie Bradley Jr., a potential center field option, good on defense, light on offense there. But there's also trades. You know, it's not just free agency. The Phillies, I think, if they are going to reshape their roster this offseason, they're going to have to make some trades and maybe even swap out some of their core to bring a different players to form kind of a new core. Give me a list of some of the players who could be available that you see in trade that the Phillies might consider going after this offseason.
Well, you have two infielders who are being paid a lot of money in Dean Gregorius and Gene Segura. I don't know what the value is in Gregorius on the trade market, especially after what Dombrowski said about him, that he's probably going to be the starter next year. But, I mean, who knows? That's a contract they'd like to get out of. Gene Segura is the kind of player who would be a really good pickup for a contending team that needs a second baseman, third baseman. He might be probably the best return that they would get. You know, he has an all-star bat. And Rhys Hoskins, who has one more year left of team control, who it feels like has been the subject of trade rumors every time he's gone through a slump. And he's gone through a slump about once or twice a year since he's been here. So he's another guy that has sneaky for power. He would probably bring a good return. He's relatively young. He would open up an opportunity for Bohm at first base. He would be somebody who would, you know, if they were able to go after Chris Bryant, then maybe Hoskins would be the guy they got rid of to bring in an outfielder. A lot of maneuverability here, and there's a lot of opportunity for, you know, there's a reason why Dombrowski came here, and it's not just because of the couple superstars. There actually is a lot of maneuverability, and there are a lot of different ways that they can go. We just have to see if he can wheel and deal here like he did at his previous stops as a GM and president of baseball ops.
Yeah, and I think that's the fascinating question. You know, what are we going to see from Dave Dombrowski this offseason? Because there is a guy like Byron Buxton who is probably going to be available to someone, but it might be a steep price. You mentioned a couple other names, Ketel Marte, Mitch Haniger. J.D. Martinez is probably more just a strict DH at this point, but you could put him in the outfield, I suppose, and just, you know, close your eyes when your team's pitching. But, you know, it's this is there are some options out there. It's going to be a fascinating offseason to see exactly how the Phillies are going to go fill two holes in the outfield, because I think you're right. I think it's a shame that they have not been able to get those early first round picks from 16, 17 and 18 or 15, 16 and 17 to pan out the way we were all hoping that they would. Well, folks, make sure you check out the piece by Evan Macy in Philly Voice, phillyvoice.com, and check out everything he's doing by getting on his Twitter feed, Evan_Macy. Evan, thanks for coming on Hitting Season. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, John. Keep it up. Listen next time, too.
Well, up next, let's do take a deep dive into the MLB playoffs and talk about the NLCS and the ALCS and some of the big storylines coming out of those series. That's up next here on Hitting Season. And we're back on Hitting Season, so let's talk about the MLB playoffs. And as we record this right now, the Houston Astros are on the verge of getting back to the World Series. They beat the Red Sox 9-1 in Game 5 of the ALCS. Framber Valdez with an 8-inning outing. Just a tremendous pitching performance from Framber, and Houston now with a 3-2 series lead over the Red Sox as the series shifts back to Houston for games 6 and 7. You got to think that the Astros are now strong favorites to get back to the World Series once again, something America did not want to see happen, but they were my pick at the start. When I did the ALC, the American League preview show for SB Nation a couple of weeks ago, I did pick Houston to come out of the American League tournament, and it looks like they are one win away from doing that. We're going to talk a little bit more about that series here in just a second. Also, as we're recording this, the Braves are leading the Dodgers late in Game 4, looking to take a 3-1 series lead. It looks like they're going to be able to finish that off, and if they do, my NL prediction will come true as well. So I missed a couple other series during my predictions, but I did pick Atlanta and Houston to face off in the World Series, with Houston winning it all, and at the moment those picks are looking good, even though they are probably the two least palatable teams I would want to see in the World Series. And essentially that's kind of why I picked them, because it's just kind of how life has gone for Phillies fans in recent seasons. So sure, why not Braves and Astros? Why not? Sure thing. Some of the big storylines to come out of these series so far. I saw Travis Salchik do a terrific Twitter thread on the length of these games here in the postseason. And I thought some of his notes were really important. If you haven't checked out his Twitter feed, make sure you go and do that. And it's on there. He did this Twitter thread on Wednesday morning. So you can go back in the timeline and take a look. But he noted that the average playoff game here in 2021 is a record 3.6 hours long. 3.6 hours long. For playoff games. Look, I love playoff baseball. And if it's an action-packed game, if there's action going, that game can go 4, 5, 6 hours. I don't care. I'm into it. But when there's so much inaction going on in these games, so much of that 3.6 hours, nothing is happening. And we're going to get into some of the reasons why here in just a second. But Game 1 of the American League Championship Series was 4 hours and 7 minutes long. Game 2 was 4 hours 8 minutes. Game 4 was 4 hours 4 minutes. And so many of these games are getting started at 8:08 Eastern Time. You're just not going to be able to have young kids up on a school night watching these games. They're able to watch the first 4 or 5 innings of most of these playoff games, and they are missing drama. This is how I got into baseball. You want to know how I got into baseball? I got into baseball watching the World Series, watching the playoffs in the late 80s. I fell in love with baseball in 1985. Okay, watching the ALCS and the NLCS, and then the World Series between the Cardinals and the Royals. I got hooked with playoff baseball. Being able to stay up a little bit late and watch some of these games, it pulled me in. I was addicted from that point on. I mean, I was kind of a casual Phillies fan in 1985, but it was those playoff games that really got me into the Phillies. And I started watching the Phillies, and then I started the World Series. Every year was so special to me. And it stinks that my kid can't, I mean, my oldest is 10. He's a baseball fanatic, as you all well know. And I can't let him stay up to watch these games when he's got school the next morning. Even when he doesn't have school the next morning, I can't let him stay up until after midnight unless it's like a clinching game. It's just it's not good for the product. It's not good for the game. This is the future of the sport. My son is a rabid baseball fan and will be for life. I'm sure of it. But he can't watch their signature event because they're 4 hours long and they don't end till after midnight, 12:30 in the morning. Consider that from 1960 to 1990, playoff games increased by 20 minutes. So starting in 1960 and then to 99. In 1990, playoff games were 20 minutes longer than they were in 1960. Okay, that's not crazy. But from 1990 to 2021, they've increased by 40 minutes. Part of this is how many pitchers are being used right now. And this is from Travis Salchik. In regular season history, each additional pitcher used increases the game by about 10 minutes. Now, more pitchers are used in the postseason. There have been 38 games this October where five or more pitchers were used by a team, which is already the fifth most all time. So back in 2014, Travis Salchik notes when he was on the Pirates beat, he placed a stopwatch on a 3-hour, 37-minute, 9-inning game between the Pirates and Cardinals. And he timed each occasion. A batter stepped out of the box with both feet. Batters stepped out 190 times that game with an average of 12.6 seconds each time. That equated to 39 minutes and 51 seconds of dead time. So you have more pitchers being used. Okay, adding time every time there's a pitching change. When you've got these bullpen games that Atlanta had to throw in Game 4, and that we've seen the Dodgers throw, and we've seen other teams, we've seen Houston do it, and Boston do it. You have seven or eight pitching changes per team when that happens. That's way too much dead time. Too much of batters stepping out. Somebody put a video of, I want to say it was Raleigh Fingers was the pitcher, but I know the hitter was Johnny Bench. Bench never steps out of the box. Never steps out of the box. I mean, maybe takes a foot out for a second and puts it right back in. Pitcher's got the ball. He's back on the rubber. I'm telling you, the pitch was delivered 10 seconds after the previous pitch. That's what the pace of baseball used to be like. Part of the other problem that we're seeing this year is foul balls. And this is a result of better pitching. Pitchers with nastier stuff. Harder fastballs. Nastier breaking pitches. This year, the foul per strike rate jumped from a near record 28% in the regular season to a record 30.4% in the playoffs. It's the first time above 30% in the pitch track era, according to Travis. That's another drag on the action, as he notes. Because when you have just a ball being caught by the catcher, he throws it back to the pitcher, you know, that's less time than when a ball goes into the stands and they got to get the umpire to throw another ball to the pitcher and the batter's going to step out and he's going to readjust everything. That takes up more time. I don't know how you fix that. I don't know that there's a way really to fix that. But great pitchers are causing hitters to foul more balls off. Those balls back in the 15, 20 years ago, those balls would have been put in play. Those balls would have been grounders or flyouts or line drives or hits or whatever. Now they're all being fouled off. And I also wonder if launch angle has something to do with it, although I'm not as anti-launch angle as everybody else. So all of this is factoring in to the fact that baseball is not drawing in casual fans. And I'm sorry. I think it's great if you're a diehard like me and you love baseball no matter what, because I do. But in order for baseball to thrive long-term, you need to draw in the casual fans during your signature moments. And the league championship series are your signature moments. The Dodgers-Giants game 5 from last Thursday night, between a 107-win team and a 106-win team, a game that went down to the last pitch, averaged 6.5 million viewers on TV on TBS. Now, that was the most watched NLDS game since game 5 of the 2017 Cubs-National Series, which drew 7 million. But that Giants-Dodgers telecast was also playing while the Bucks and the Eagles were on Thursday Night Football on Fox. And that game drew 14.5 million viewers. 8 million more viewers than a do-or-die baseball game between the two best teams in baseball this year. Between a dead-walking Eagles team and the Buccaneers. That's just, it makes me sad. That happens. But some of what we're talking about with how long these games are going and the pace of play factors into it. And I love the game. I say this because I love the game and because I want my son to be able to watch more baseball and because I want kids to embrace baseball. Baseball's healthy. It's you know, the fans are attending baseball games in stadiums now that the coronavirus is the vaccines are here and people can get vaccinated and go to baseball games. But it has lost something here. And I think we need to try and think of ways to fix some of this stuff when we can, whether that means pitch clock, whether that means batters don't step out of the box, whatever it means. Emphasizing starting pitching. And this is one of the other areas I wanted to get into, the death of starting pitching in the postseason. Starters are getting on average 12 outs per start in the playoffs heading into Wednesday's game. Okay, starting pitchers are averaging 4 innings per start in the postseason. Now, this is before Framber Valdez pitched his 8-inning gem in Game 5 of the ALCS. That 4 innings per start would be the lowest mark in any postseason all time. Buster Olney noted in a tweet, he said, there's a desperate need for the MLB, the Players Association, to talk about all the pitching changes and restoring the preeminence of the starting pitchers. It'd be better for the product, it'd be better for the union, given the importance of starters in setting market prices. I don't know how you do that. I think that's good to say. I don't disagree with that sentiment, but how do you do that? How do you tell the Players Association to get teams to focus more on starting pitchers? The only way I can see is if you reduce the number of pitchers or relievers that teams can carry on a postseason roster. I mean, would that help mimic the limitations managers are forced to deal with during the regular season? Because part of the issue here is that managers have these frequent off days during the playoffs, and you can manage your bullpen differently. But it's odd that a team like the Braves has to go to a bullpen game in a game 4 where you only have a 2-1 series lead. Like, you don't have a fourth starting pitcher you can use. I know that Ynoa went out for the NLCS with an injury, so maybe they got kind of hamstrung there. But the Red Sox and Astros have gone with bullpen games on purpose too. And managers are super quick to pull a starting pitcher because they understand that if you let a starting pitcher go too long and they get blown up, they're going to get destroyed. The manager's going to get destroyed. The GM's going to get destroyed. It's terrifying to think of a starting pitcher facing a lineup a third time, let alone even a second time in some of these cases. I mean, I think back to the 2001 Diamondbacks with Schilling and Randy Johnson. You know, think back to some of the great starting pitching rotations in the playoffs. I miss those marquee starting pitching matchups that we still get once in a while, but we just don't get them much anymore. And if you have starters in there for longer, it's fewer pitching changes. People know who the starters are too. The casual fans know who Max Scherzer is. They know who Julio Urias is. They know who the starters are. They don't know who the fifth guy out of the bullpen is. That's not really why people tune in. People tune in to see the starting pitching matchups. You know, people don't tune in to watch the backup quarterback. They tune in to watch the starters. And football's different, obviously. But you're talking about your marketable players. The players who are the most marketable, aside from the stray Mariano Riveras of the world, are your starting pitchers. Those are the ones that need to be front and center, and they're not lasting. They're not pitching more than an hour of the game. So I don't know how you fix that. I don't know how you strengthen it and emphasize starting pitchers in the postseason. But it really would behoove baseball to try and figure out a way to do that, because Astros starting pitchers, again, before Framber Valdez's outstanding Game 5 start, had a combined 6 2/3 scoreless innings pitched through 4 games of the ALCS. The starters in 6 2/3 innings had a 21.60 ERA through the first 4 games of that series. Relievers in those 36 innings had a 2.75 ERA. So you can see why the Astros are doing what they're doing. The starters just weren't giving them anything. But still, not awesome. Not awesome for the product. All right, some fun postseason stats to finish off the podcast here. Cody Bellinger hit a game-tying 3-run home run in the 8th inning of the ALCS back in game 3, trailing 2 games to none. They looked like they were dead. Jose Altuve also hit a game-tying solo home run in the eighth inning of Game 4 of the ALCS. It's only the third day in postseason history with multiple game-tying home runs in the eighth inning or later. The only others were on October 1st of 98 and October 3rd of 95. These are dramatic moments, and I'm telling you, no kids on the East Coast saw Cody Bellinger's three-run home run. As a kid, that would have hooked me. That would have absolutely hooked me. Jose Altuve now has 21 home runs in the postseason, third most ever. Ever. He only trails Manny Ramirez, who has 29, and Bernie Williams, who has 22. Jose Altuve has three game-tying or go-ahead postseason home runs in the eighth inning or later in his career. Tied for second most all-time, he trails only Bernie Williams, who has four. And Altuve is the fastest player in postseason history to reach 21 home runs. He has 21 home runs in 71 playoff games. I mean, golly. That's just incredible. NLCS Game 3, again, this was the Dodgers win. It was the 82nd time in Dodgers postseason history that they trailed by three or more runs in the eighth inning or later. It's the first time they had ever won such a game. You want to know how unreal that Cody Bellinger home run was? Dodgers had a 6% chance of winning that game after the bottom of the seventh. But it was Cody Bellinger's fourth career game-tying or go-ahead hit in the eighth inning or later of a playoff game, tied for fifth most in postseason history, behind only Bernie Williams, Pete Rose, David Ortiz, and J.D. Drew. Through nine postseason games, this was, again, coming into Game 5, the Red Sox set a new franchise record for 21 home runs in a single postseason. The Braves-Dodgers is just the third series in postseason history in which the winning team took the lead in their final at-bat in each of the first three games. And the ALCS between the Astros and Red Sox is the first playoff series in history to have three straight games decided by seven or more runs. So it's, you have the NLCS, which has just been nip and tuck throughout. And the ALCS has been one blowout after another. So you have in the ALCS, the first in playoff history between the Astros and Red Sox in which three straight games were decided by more than seven runs. By seven or more runs. Meanwhile, each of the first three games of the NLCS were decided by a single run. Just a very weird postseason that we're having so far, but I think it's been a great postseason so far if you've been able to stay up to watch it. All right, folks, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. Hey, my thanks once again to the outstanding Evan Macy for coming on the podcast. Folks, if you haven't done so already, again, please go over to the Hittin' Season Patreon. Go to patreon.com/hittin'season and sign up on one of our tiers there. And listen, on the next podcast, I want to take some of your mailbag questions, but we're going to do it through the Apple Podcast review area. So go to Apple Podcast, leave a 5-star rating for the Good Fight Podcast feed, and ask your question there, and I'll answer them on the next podcast. As a matter of fact, me, Justin, and Liz will answer your questions on the next podcast, but you got to leave it at the Apple Podcast rating and review section, and we will answer your questions there. Just trying something new out and seeing what we can get from Apple Podcasts and whether or not you guys are able to tap into that and ask a question there as well. Also, tell your friends about us. We're on Spotify, wherever it is that you get your podcasts. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.